I was up in the photography department studio on the top floor of the college building. The large southwesterly facing windows were allowing a flood of golden light to wash over the set as the students and technicians hurried about to make the most of the golden hour. Suddenly, a flurry of panic erupted from the lighting team, whose remit on this job was to reflect, rechannel, and redistribute the natural light onto the set with an array of mirrors, crystals, glass rods, and fiber optics. One of them approached me and thrust a slim, hurriedly wrapped yellow paper package into my hand. It resembled an old Super 8 prepayment envelope, but it was rectangular, about the length of a blues harmonica. "Could you run down and get us another?" she said. "One should do it." "Sure," I said, and made my way downstairs to exit the building. On the way down the first flight, I realized I didn't know exactly what this package contained, what sort of device or instrument it was, nor where I would likely find one. So I sidestepped into the offices on the fourth floor and rapped against a technician's hatch. "Hi, do you know what this is?" I asked the head that emerged. "I've been asked to get another one." "Haven't got an idea, mate," said the technician. "It was being used in a photo shoot," I said. "Well, then you want to ask in the photography department." "I thought I was in the photography department," I replied. But, as was summarily explained to me, I was mistaken. They were just shooting in the mixed-use loft of the building, and the photography department was actually two floors down, on the second floor. So I hopped on down the stairs and asked the first person I saw, "Hey, do you know what this is?" "Let's have a look inside," they said. I hadn't thought to open the package until that point. They flipped open one end of the pack and out slid some kind of glass tube in a steel truss containing a cloud of dark pigment suspended in a clear viscous fluid. Never seen one of these before. So I made my way out of the building and to the adjacent photographic supply store. By this point, I must have been gone a good 30 or 40 minutes. Must have looked desperate, judging by the tone of the kid behind the counter. "Do you need some help? You look a bit lost," he said. "I'm looking for a replacement for one of these, but I don't really know what it is." He took one look at it. "Yep, one sec," he said, disappearing round the back. He returned a half minute later, holding a freshly packaged whatever it was. "Here you go," he said. "Do you need it prepped?" "Prepped? I don't know," I replied. "Do you know what this is, what it does? You want me to show you?" he asked. "Well, go on then," I said. He then broke the seal at the top of the tube by partially unscrewing it, and giving it a brisk shake, mixed the pigment and clear fluid together until a flat, dusky grey filled the vial. Then he pulled out a small needle attached to the loop in a steel clasp, and following the guidance of some faint lines printed on the tube, he made a series of pin pricks into the glass, which allowed microscopic bubbles of air to work their way into the tube. As he upended it and let it settle, the pigment began to slowly separate from the fluid again. "Now, do you know what grade they're shooting at?" he asked. "The prick pattern determines the target grade, you see." "I don't have any idea what you're talking about." "I thought you were studying this stuff," the kid said. "No, I was just helping out. I actually didn't know why I was in the photography department. I trailed off as I realized I couldn't place the names or faces of anyone I'd been assisting with at the shoot, or why I was there in the first place." "I'm sorry," I said. "My memory's shot," offered the assistant. "Look, If the target grade is dark, i.e. they want a lot of contrast in these picks, then we have to oxidize the pigment at around 80%. That means pricking out 8 of the 10 of these horizontal lines you see and working through in a spiral to get the mixture right. Then you pop out this little brush. He flicked some part at the end of the tube and a brush appeared somehow. You paint the photographic medium, the target medium, just a light coat. Don't overdo it. But this needs to be done within 20 minutes of this mixing process. 20 minutes? It had almost taken me that long to get out of the building. Well, you better get on your way, he said. That's 13,301. Seemed pretty reasonable to me. I guess subsidized student prices. Look, I've just pricked it up at 30%, he said. So if you get there and they want a higher contrast, then you can just add the other pricks later. As I hurried back to the college building, I noticed there were many students congregating outside the main entrance in a hushed sort of atmosphere. When I went inside to the main stairwell, people were loosely assembled in an anxious hush at the base of the stairs, looking upwards, as if listening for something, trying to piece together what was happening in the halls above. But I didn't have time to hang around like this. I only had 15 minutes to get back to the chute. So I slipped through these people and made my way up the stairs. In the upper halls, it was deadly quiet. Where there had been a bustling corridor of students in conversation, laughing or debating, there were now just empty spaces and ominous hush. I pushed through this eerie stillness and up the final flight into the room where the shoot had taken place. At this point, I feel I should describe the room, as it's important to understand what happened next. The room was a large open-plan L-shaped studio, which, before the conversion of this building, had apparently been the penthouse suite of the architect who designed it. The entrance was via a hatch at the top of a spiral cantilevered staircase that wound around a central concrete shaft, bringing you directly up to floor level, with no corridor or porchway. There were three large arch windows on the south-facing side and on the east-facing side, and set some 2 meters back from these windows was an L-shaped breakfast bar, following the general floor plan of the room. It was upon this that the many accoutrements of the photographic shoot had been placed by the crew. The staircase brought you into the room in the northeastern corner, so when you stepped into the room, on your left were the three broad arch windows, and ahead of you, you could see one of the south-facing windows. At the time I'd been sent out to obtain the mystery device, the room had held about 8 people in total. The photographer, the lighting technicians, the makeup artist, the busboy, the crank hand, the click rabbit, and the model. And there was myself, of course. But presently, upon entering the loft, it was void of people altogether. Or so it seemed. Photographic gear, bags, personal effects, and pieces of clothing had been abandoned in a rush and were strewn about the place, and everything was deathly quiet. Until I heard a shrill, rattling, wheezing sound emitting from the western corner of the room, the source of which was absent from view but distressingly present nonetheless. And as these scraping, rasping sounds slowly raised in pitch to a waspy hum, I beheld, floating into view from the edge to the south, a large maroon sphere about the size of a beach ball, hewn from something dull and brittle like clay. As it emerged further into view, I could see a gargantuan hand clasped at its side, its fingers jumbling in a clumsy ripple, stopping a series of holes in a sloppy, plunging rhythm. Then, as the bulk of the orb bore into view, I glimpsed atop a large coiling spout emitting the sound. Before, finally, I saw the bloated and grotesque head blowing into the mouthpiece of this diabolical ocarina. And as the instrument and its blower turned the corner to face me, I could see their eyes were shut, seemingly lost in the sound they were emitting, which by this point resembled a yawning squawk, like someone pinching out the larynx of a startled goose. This music amplified, reverberating against the walls as they slowly continued towards me, unaware of my presence. As the pitch and volume rose to a crescendo, the players' hands shook, their eyes watered, and their cheeks rippled. Suddenly they drew the instrument away from their mouth and gasped, opening their eyes, looking up at the ceiling, panting and weeping. Then they slowly lowered their head, opened their eyes, and met my terrified gaze. "Take this," they said, shoving the instrument into my hands. It was surprisingly light as a beach ball, but brittle and fragile as the clay balloon it was. "Blow that end," they said. "Move your fingers over the holes until you get the desired frequencies." "What, now?" I asked. "Yes, now. Have you brought the eotogram?"
"The what?"
"The eotogram. I heard you prepped it already with a three-step."
"Give it here."
They snatched the yellow package from my hands.
"This is the only way we're going to clear them all out of here," they say. "Then the place is ours again."
Taking the tube in their hands, they break the pin off its holster on the side and jam it in one of the holes, while at the same time flicking the popping brush out from one end, as previously demonstrated, only now they bite the base of the brush in their teeth and draw the thing out swiftly from their mouth, stripping all the bristles off brush head and spitting them over the breakfast bar. The bristles flutter in the air like seeds on a breeze. Beneath the brush is a gleaming mouthpiece, which they put to their lips and blow. The sound is at first inaudible, high-pitched like a dog whistle. Then as they begin piercing the tube with the needle, the pitch lowers as thin jets of black liquid spritz out into the air around us. They give me a nod, indicating that I should start playing, which I do. The dark mist blown out of the eotogram in front of me seems to hang and settle in the air. Slowly, the outlines of shapes begin to develop, materializing into traces of furniture, piles of books, a dog asleep on a rug. Keeping a stream of air passing through my instrument starts to have a dizzying effect on me. As the dark shapes continue to appear, they begin to sink into an enveloping paleness that spreads across the face of the world. As the last gasps of air leave my lungs, I fall into unconsciousness. When I finally awake, I'll be in my armchair, facing the southern window, watching the last long shadows of the day stretch across the city, cutting through the golden embers from the setting sun. Chunky will be on the chair beside me, their lovely, soft, oversized head lolling gently in the evening stillness. "What happened?" I'll say. "Did I?" "Don't worry," they'll say. "They've all gone now. They've all gone," they'll say.